Hello, this is King's College School Theatre Society. Yesterday we went to see The Convert at the Gate Theatre in Notting Hill. We're going to discuss what particularly struck us about the performances.
Well, the first thing I was wondering about is, given what was it like seeing that sort of story being told in that very particular space? Because the last time we went, we've been to much bigger theatres. I think that's probably the smallest venue we've been to in a while.
I think especially for us sitting on the sides, really close to it, we were completely immersed in the performance space. We were in the room with them. And there were often times when you're being blocked by an actor, but I think that made it all the more involved because you're in the room with them and it's almost as if you're watching from the side in the actual room.
The intensity was definitely something that struck out because you were in such an intimate situation. Along with the ambient music that was played in the background, was just noticeable actually being only a couple, maybe a metre or so away from an actor who is doing some intense scene or being attacked by someone else is just especially completely different to being far away.
Especially as at one point you got props thrown at you.
That was
quite close up.
I thought the sound was really intimidating. Just the voices, not just the music, but because there were so many sort of very intense scenes that when somebody really shouted and let rip, it bounced off all the walls and you felt so trapped in it.
I loved the juxtaposition between the original language that was spoken and then the English dialect, and times, especially with Prudence, when her sort of old dialect would slip back and then she'd force herself to speak more posh, and that was really interesting.
I think it was there was a point where he said something, it was an English phrase, but he got it confused and said it.
A bag of mixtures.
A bag of mixed bags. That was really clever. I really like that.
What's all about going round in circles?
Yeah, well, I've wrote some of them down, actually. Just some fantastic phrases. I mean, that was a big thing I really enjoyed as well. And at the start of the play, it was quite enchanting hearing the English language, having this sort of cultural filter, and it was quite delightful. But as the some of the characters became more sinister, than these sort of, they lost their enchantment. But I feel we run in the circular. Oh goodness of gracious was a really good one. It was very vivid. It was like hearing the language anew and at one remove. That was very very notable thing for me.
One of the things that struck me was I think you and I definitely talked about this in the interval was how the actor playing Esther, how we couldn't quite figure out how old she was or how old her character was meant to be.
Yeah.
Because when she first came on, her mannerisms...
Yeah, she had this, childlike naivety, almost like a newborn child who was watching, the flicker of every movement with her eyes and the way she'd carry in the tea and sort of, be led by gravity almost.
That was so specific, wasn't it? The way in which
she'd pick up the tea and she'd come round and bring it to the side and...
She was so clumsy.
Yeah.
It was like either like old woman clumsy or sort of extremely young child who hasn't quite got the coordination yet. And I wasn't sure whether she was just a bad actor. part of the character, but it was part of the character. So.
I loved the subtlety of her character progression.
Yeah.
Because there was no one point where you were now she's speaking in perfect English. It happened so seamlessly.
Yeah.
And with each new moment that she came on stage, she'd have sort of a different mannerism that had sort of flickered into being more English and more Roman Catholic.
It went really still. I mean, when you watch her in those sort of final scenes, all of the expression was just very, very minuscule, just in her eyes almost, not even with the rest of the body.
Yeah.
And thinking back on it now, I thought it was beautiful when I watched it, but now thinking back on it, I feel really sad that is what her education cost her as well as everything else. That we lost that kind of beautiful, naive, childlike innocence and playfulness.
It was a fantastic character arc for any actor to play that. I mean, and when she came on for that shattering final scene, I was struck by how still she was. We didn't know where she was. She'd gone missing, and then she just walked in very calmly, very reassuringly. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a nice downbeat ending.
Okay.
No, I saw the that she was wrapped in a cloak.
Yeah.
I thought, oh,
there's something under there.
There's something
under
there.
Yeah.
There's something under there.
And stupidly, I thought it might be something that she was going to attack her mentor with.
Really?
But of course, yeah. Well, that thought crossed my mind.
I thought she had like attacked the police and she was injured because at one point she said there isn't very much time left, and I thought she was going to reveal that she was dying rather than she'd killed everybody.
Lovely. What I found really interesting about the whole thing is that even by the end, when she almost became more educated than him and more devout, she always called him master. There were points where they seemed almost equal, and her maybe even having a control over him, but she always referred to him as master, never anything else. I just, throughout the whole thing, maybe that's just me seeing it as something else, but I thought it was interesting.
I think that as the master, wanted to have this control over the protege, and I don't think he ever intended for her to become higher than him or more educated than him. So even when she called the white man out on his Bible studies and how she could pick out the exact verse because she could absorb everything, I don't think he liked that. I think he much preferred being the sort of all-knowing man in a society where, like, he is the black man who's always going to be below the white man. So I think he wanted to create his own sort of white man figure over someone else, almost like a class divide within the black community.
Well, you had the character of Prudence who kept saying, actually,
I'm more clever than
I am
him.
More
yeah.
educated than Chelfie, than any of the men.
But she still couldn't fight for the rights of... Yeah.
They wouldn't tell you that, and it's preserving almost that we are the male dominant. And actually, even when they finally, the two women realise, and they go and say, let's use our oratory skills to go and save...
It just fails.
It just fails, and it doesn't end up at all.
I think it's quite uncharitable to say that he just wanted to dominate them, because he did feel a great sense of sadness that he wasn't able to bring out the rest of his community into what he felt was the right way to go.
I still think he did enjoy the knowledge he had over them in that situation. I think although his main intention probably was to convert and to preach, he did enjoy knowing something that someone else didn't know.
I guess he felt that he'd bettered himself and did feel he was on a higher plane than the rest of them. But at the end, obviously, he realised that all his teachings didn't actually help when the white man got involved.
Yeah.
Touching on that point, I think it's really interesting that we never actually see the white colonisers themselves.
Yeah, I was saying that to Holly.
It really kind of emphasises the divide within the native kind of population that their arrival caused. So
they're all discussing the problems that the white man have created, and everything's to do with the white man, in a sense, if you look at it. But then he's just never there, and it's almost as if their own problems aren't even enough for the white man to be involved in.
It sort of says that their real sort of... the main threat that they pose is the influence that they have, rather than, well, you know, alongside what they do, but obviously just in terms of dividing beliefs and kind of causing a rift, that kind of is the... cornerstone of
they
the
were still
play,
a presence in the play, even though Acton was representing them.
Of course,
Who do we think the convert of the title was? Was that Esther? Was it the master?
Probably in the way the master, because I noticed at the end he almost became quite childlike with his manner, and she became very self-contained, quite puddled, almost as a child was. As Esther was at the beginning, and she actually held her hand out to him. So very much that role reverse, and suddenly she was saying that his course to conversion as he'd done with her.
Except at that time she was asking for his absolution. What a shattering final scene. Sorry, I've used that adjective before, but the first half, it was quite a long first half, wasn't it? But I think that was probably right. I think trying to tag anything else on to that third act would have been too much in a way.
I almost thought the first act was going to end when the Matambe starts singing the song at her, the Jekasai song, and she starts sort of covering her ears and like trying to pray over it. And it was that sort of dichotomy that I thought would have been a really effective sort of... I didn't realise that there was so much more yet to come.
No.
Yeah.
But even then there was already so much conflict set up in that story. What I also found interesting was Tamba's speech about... how he felt emasculated by the whole process of by the white colonizers, and speaking of how Chilfie and Chansey could be men, and that he was taken from him, and that was sort of in some ways the reasons for what he was doing, as well as sort of having nothing and that sort of thing. And it really showed, it cast that sort of speech, which can often